Hey y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Ramon, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm a board-certified OBGYN, sexual medicine and specialist and menopause specialist as well. Today, I'm stepping outside of the pelvis into the heart, but they're always intertwined and interrelated. So, but we know that heart disease is still the number one killer in women. And yet, you know, women die earlier from their first heart attack. We underdiagnose it. The bias that exists continues to cause women to not get the appropriate care that they need. We normalize their symptoms because we say that they should have an elephant crushing heart pain, chest pain. Sometimes they have other symptoms. And in communities like mine, Dr. Botts, who we're going to talk about, is South Asian communities especially, we have earlier disease at lower BMIs. We have significant dyslipidemia and diabetes that are really predispose us as a population. And so today I'm thrilled to invite Dr. Ami Bhatt, who's a cardiologist at Harvard Medical School. She's a chief innovation officer, the American College of Cardiology, and the chair of the FDA Digital Health Advisory Committee. Is that right? I'm going to have her also reintroduce herself, but today I want to talk about AI as collaborative intelligence, the bias in cardiovascular algorithms, South Asians and heart disease, midlife women, wearables, all the things, all the new innovation for prevention that we are coming about in this age of, you know, rapidly changing technology. Yeah. So thank you, Dr. Bhatt, for being here. Ami, I appreciate you being here. This is exciting. I love learning about other things happening in other sectors.
Thank you for having me. No, this is great. And I feel like the key thing is none of these things happen by themselves, right? We don't one day have something with our heart and the next day a question about our wearable and the next day, you know, a gynecologic issue. Like all of them are happening all the time. And so I love being here and I love talking about it in the perspective of like, we are a whole person and there's like a holistic approach to what's going on. So this is
cool. I think there's so much like new social science data around how patients really, when they get dismissed, they really feel like things are so siloed that they're only looked at on like their organ of treatment, right? And so I do think there's this huge aspect of that that happens in medicine. And we really need to think of the whole person in front of us. And I think that's where like my understanding of menopause and perimenopause has really helped me to be a better doctor because
Yes. Don't
always just think of gynae stuff now because hormones are affecting every cell in your body, so it makes sense that X, Y, and Z are happening. But before we get started on this great discussion, tell me, I'm Gyno Girl, so I like a good backstory. So tell me your backstory. What brought you into this field? Why cardiology? Why all the things that you're doing now?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I guess the short version is the following. Came to Boston wanting to do medicine and pediatrics. I was going to like be able to see anyone who walked through the door. Like I want to be the like typical Norman Rockwell doctor. Yeah. And fell in love with cardiology specifically. But interestingly, I fell in love with cardiology because of this population of patients called adult congenital heart disease patients, kids who had heart disease right at the time that I was there. And like, I didn't know I was a builder. Now we refer to these big people like me as like, oh, she's a builder. She sees a need and then she goes to build something. I didn't know that. I just knew like, hey, there's nobody to take care of them on the adult side. Yeah. I'm trained in pediatrics and adult. There are a couple of people doing this. Seems like there's room in the field. It's a need, and I'm going to do this. And that really kickstarted kind of my career in digital health, which maybe makes no sense until I tell you they wanted to FaceTime with me because they were in their 20s and FaceTime was a thing. And I was like, no, no, I will be arrested. Like, this is bad. And so I started doing telemedicine back in the 2010s when not a lot of us were doing it. It wasn't actually compensated at all sometimes, if not well. And then once you start seeing a patient across the screen, you think, huh, I need to figure out how to work with a digital stethoscope or is there a handheld ultrasound? And then not only the data and technology, like how do I get my hands on the patient, but how do I teach the person in the community what they need to know about taking care of someone, not so that they can do like exquisite something level, whatever, but just good enough to triage. This I can take care of, this is going to... I'm going to send a Dr. Bhatt at Mass General Hospital. And so I started thinking about education at a distance. And then I realized, well, I got to educate my patients too, because who's a better advocate than like you for yourself? And so fast forward many years into COVID, I was the director of the Mass General Hospital outpatient clinics. By the way, you learn so much by sometimes taking a role that is outside of your normal scope. So this was like a management role. Nobody reported to me. And then I had all these really good friends of mine who had their own really nice practices, small private, own secretary, you know.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to go to 43 rooms with admins out front. And people were like, what? This is the end of medicine. And I wasn't great at it. Let's be honest. Like, my first management job. But boy, do you learn a lot from not being strong at something and teaching yourself and figuring out, oh, I need to learn this better about personalities or people or how to present or communication. And I think all that added up together to when we got to COVID, we had to turn on telemedicine. So we were there. And then we repurposed clinical research assistants who were young people, pretty facile with tech, not to be ageist, but we repurposed them as at the elbow telemedicine help, right? And they felt useful. And so it was an interesting experience. So when I came out of COVID at Mass General and the opportunity to be this chief innovation officer role at American College of Cardiology, I was like, yeah, I'll take it. And it grew so quickly to something so different than what it was when I took it, because AI was like, oh, you're going to take a new job that might be related to AI. Here you go. Bam. Yeah. And like, here it was. And so again, learning, growing. And so my big initiative now is called the AI Enabled Clinician. Mm-hmm. And it is a campaign to have anybody who considers themselves a clinician, doctor, nurse, caregiver, family member, community health worker, understand AI. And then the partner to that is the patients understand it as well. And so that's where I am today in a way. And the FDA really just fits well with that, because some of these technologies, we got to figure out how they fit into the patient's life, into the clinician's life, and make things better and make that road easier for people. And so all of that kind of comes together nicely in my new career, if you will.
That's amazing. I've done a lot of like back research on AI too, just because, you hear about all the things that are going to get replaced with AI. You know, I think there was some guy that was on the Chase Health Medical Conference, and he's like, we tell doctors that AI is not going to replace them so they can work with us, but AI is going to replace them. You know, so like it was one of the things, and you're just like, oh, how could it do this? And so I started looking at AI myself a lot, just like in its application to medicine. I find it interesting because I think it can be a very great adjunct to so many good people. And I've talked about this on my podcast before. I've seen like patients who are neurodivergent who don't know how the words to communicate, right? There's this low cultural cultural health capital that exists within medicine, and whether or not you can communicate well with those people who's in front of you, right? Like if I communicate with someone, then I'm going to get better care.
That's right.
And so I have patients who have used like AI to tell me that they might have vulvodynia or vestibulodynia because they've been able to now know what's down there, right? And so it's true. You do better communicate with people when they have a better understanding of their own anatomy.
So
tell me how you're looking at it in terms of like from a cardiology perspective or how you see it. I mean, because I know that I love how you say that it's more of a collaborative intelligence instead of artificial intelligence. Yeah. But also speak to the clinicians out there who are like really scared that their job is going to be worth anything.
Yeah. So I think there's a few ways to think about it. And the first thing to me is when you're sitting with your patients, you have maybe 20 minutes. Let's be realistic. How much time do we get nowadays? Yeah. The amount of knowledge that there is out there between their electronic health record, the guidelines, the research since the guidelines about their multiple things that you're probably trying to address, their feelings about it, their social determinants, your drivers of health, and then their wearable. Like, ain't no way my brain is going to be able to 20 minutes. Like, it's just not going to happen. And so now, what we want AI for is, hey, can you pull all that together for me? Can you give me a summary? And if there's anything in there that doesn't seem right to me, I'm going to go to the source. I'm going to confirm. I'm going to make sure. But can you just like pull and trigger me to think about certain things on a negative way, but in a positive trigger, like remind me about certain things?
Yeah.
That would be really helpful. And so that's that collaborative intelligence, right? Because we don't want the computer to think for us. We're not asking for that. Right now, we're just asking for the computer to use its compute power to get all the things that we don't have time to get, give it to us, let us use our clinical acumen. So that's how I want doctors, nurses, others to think about it. Now, the key is companies are going to come at you and say, I can provide you with this. I can save these many hours. I can save these many dollars. And our answer is clinicians back. Like an AI-enabled clinician's answer is, how are you going to help me make patient care better? And the company's got to be able to answer that question. Like that's next, right? And so that's what I'm trying to achieve with the AI-enabled clinician. Understand what the technologies are. What is a large language model? How does it work in imaging, right? Understand the basics. You don't have to be able to create it.
Yeah.
Maybe understand how to generate good prompts and do some vibe coding with the things you have, right? But mostly understand how to talk with the companies and say, this is my unmet need. How are you going to answer that? Rather than how can I fit your square peg in this round hole? And I think that's really, when I say AI-enabled clinician, I want us to feel empowered to help the tech industry, to help the VC firms put the money, put the effort into the things that are actually going to make patient care better. And that's where the patients and clinicians can partner too. Because we all, as patients and as clinicians, we all have the same goal, which is we want to actually make patient care better. And in the beginning, all of the AI that was implemented so far, largely back office, largely administrative. Look, I love making the paper-oriented workload less for clinicians. Like, I am all over that. However, I don't want people to push on efficiency, burn out people further, not need clinicians there because they think they can do it with AI, right? Are there things that can be done with AI? Sure. Look at Doctronic, right? You can do med refills with AI probably better than you can with a human. That's not necessarily replacing a job. Pharmacists still have jobs. Doctors, nurses still have jobs. But how many times if I try and go get a medication refilled, like, do I fail at that, right? Or is it hard? Or do I give up? Or do I not trust the health system? Well, those downstream things that are actually really unsafe for me, like, could happen. And instead, if you have AI as a backup. So there are places, yes, where AI may take things over, but it's not directly from a human in the provision of medicine. It is in places where we already are kind of not doing great and failing. And now AI is our safety backstop. That's where I want to see it. And that's where I need clinicians. And I'm so glad you do this podcast because we're reaching more people to say, it's not replacing you. You have to tell it where it belongs. And that physician voice, that nurse voice is a little bit lost right now. We've got to find that.
And I think that's because you're right. There's either fear around it or this like, oh, I don't get that tech stuff. You know, like you just hear people say, like, I don't know computer science. I'm not going to learn that stuff. And so I think those AI physicians or clinicians that don't use it are really going to be behind the eight ball when it comes to something.
And there's not a world in which that tech stuff exists, right? Like, so digital health is not over there. It's the field of digital health is gone. The field of digital health is health. Like health has all the digital abilities. We need to use them because we can't do it without it. The AI is here. We need to figure out how to harness it. And other people outside of us are coming into our lane. And so we've got to understand and not make them outsiders, but say, okay, but we're the coordinators of this. So let's help coordinate it, right? And so I think those partnerships are also so important. So I want clinicians to hear that there is not a, I don't get the tech stuff. Like if you're going to be a doctor or a nurse or a community health worker, the tech stuff is actually what's going to enable you to do a really good job.
We talk about a lot of the social determinants of health and really nuanced healthcare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's some data suggesting one person uses ChatGPT and is a woman of color, she'll get a different answer than someone who's white or a male. And so, you know, there's this whole idea of algorithmic bias and who's making the algorithms and who's putting that information into the LLMs. Like, is there a world where that black box that exists can be modified to really create more nuance? I mean, you know, is there a world where someone that has complex sexual health needs or vulvovaginal disorders is not going to get like, you know, a once spit it out algorithmic automated answer, right?
Yeah. So here's the thing, right? The large language models are giving us answers based on the relationship of words existing in the world today. So if there's not a lot of information about that readily available to it, first of all, then it may not, the average ChatGPT may not be able to give you an answer because that data is not out there. Now, let's say you and your colleagues created something where you forced the data that you know that's important, your own knowledge into it, and built something of a large language model that said, hey, if you have questions about this type of vulvovaginal issues, health, et cetera, and then that information is in there, okay, now we're getting somewhere, right? Now they're getting kind of some version of your brains and papers you know and research that you put in. And so I think part of the magic of large language models is not people going out there and being able to like find everything, but us actually being able to build for our patients knowledgeable, you know, areas that they can go to, chatbots, agents, other things, to be able to ask those questions and then step it up to us when it's something that's like, oh, that's a little more complicated. So that's the excitement. The other thing I'd say, though, is there's something that can be positive or negative about your large language model. There is a Wall Street Journal reporter, Nicole, who's a good friend of mine. She reports on personal tech and health. And she asked like three different large language models questions. And then, you know, she wanted to grade them and stuff. And I said, I looked at her outputs and I realized her outputs are different than mine with the same question, because my ChatGPT, Claude, Gemini has learned me based on my question history. So it is learning who I am. And now it is putting that bias of who it thinks I am into the answers it gives me. So I get really great digital health answers that she could never get. But yeah, she can get great answers about personal tech that I'm not going to get, right? And so mm-hmm. you have to think about the lens of whose LLM did you look in also, right? Yeah. And if you yeah. tend to do Ayurvedic medicine,
yeah,
it may give you that before it gives you a statin for a South yeah. Asian woman who's trying to protect herself from the number one killer of women, right? Like, And so I think those are some of the things that we have to, again, teach people. That's what it means to be AI enabled. It doesn't mean I can cope. It means I get how this thing works and why it works this way. It's like, you know, your freezer. If you turn the temperature up too much, everything has ice on it. Someone's got to teach you, turn the temperature down a little bit. It doesn't need to be that cold and you won't get ice on all your food, right? And, but until somebody tells you that, God, I mean, when I'm just thinking about when I like was first leaving college and like this happened to me. And I was like,
my food's washed.
You know, that, you know, those are the kind of things that we need to start sharing. Yeah.
Yeah. With the work that you're doing with the FDA, like a lot of, do you remember, a couple months ago, they had announced the doomsday countdown was like, yeah, you know, was closer because of, and one mm-hmm. of the reasons they listed that we're closer to the apocalypse, I forget the body of science that did this now, like, okay. But it was because of the unregulation around it, yeah, like that especially countries like, you know, us and other arenas are not regulating what's happening with AI. And so, you know, my husband's a big, you know, tech geek, science geek person who is just thinking about, like, you know, when AI is going to come and attack us like the Terminator. He's like, I'm going to have to come back in another form and come and save the humanity.
Yeah. No. So here, look, there's so many ways to think about this. So the first is the people who really do AI are probably the most scared right now, because an unregulated model can do a lot of things. I mean, this morning I was at a conference. We have Boston Tech Week this week, so it has been amazing in Boston. Like, it when you really realize that we are the new hub of where tech and AI engineering is coming from, like, no doubt. Sorry, Silicon Valley, but like, yeah, Boston is where all the brains are right now, right? And it's amazing. And so this week has been incredible, but there were some people who said no, like, there have been times where you're like, nope. And then the AI wiped out all of my data. Model wasn't regulated. People weren't like literally just wiped out data. And so there were stories this morning of people who are deep into this who say regulated AI is important. Now, there's a difference in what you're talking about with regulation. There is an AI model that is safe. There are things we're putting in place that have protections. There's privacy security for data. There's cybersecurity, huge risks that people are addressing. And so that's all like at that science and model level. Then there's a regulation you're talking about with me, which, yes, includes all of that. But at the FDA, and I'm not speaking for the government, but that's a different type of regulation, which is how are things getting through? What needs permission and what doesn't. What is wellness? What is a wellness claim? What is a medical claim, right? When do you need it? And so those are the kind of things. And I will say, one of the fears I have, one of the other meetings I was at this morning, we talked about this. One of the things I want to solve for is I don't want us to deregulate so far that like there's not control, people to understand. But I also don't want us to backswing. Let's say things change, right? Governments change every 4 years. Things are happening every 2 years. Into like an overregulated where all the companies that we're designing now run out of money, can't do things, and really good science doesn't get to people and help them. And yeah. So neither side is really good. And what we need to build is really, we need to build an infrastructure. Good AI governance is an infrastructure with guardrails. It's not just the guardrails. It's not the lack of guardrails. It is building the infrastructure with the guardrails to say, here's how we're going to use AI to make blank better. In my case, it's healthcare. And I think that's what I want our model to be when we're advocating on the Hill, when we're talking as companies and clinicians and patients is, hey, what's the infrastructure? Everybody's got to be all in on there's an infrastructure to use AI and that has guardrails. But if we say, oh, I'm going to regulate everything, nothing's going to get done. If I deregulate everything, nothing's going to get done.
Yeah.
You need the infrastructure and then you need the guardrails. And so I really want us to have a national approach where like that's the way we're thinking. And when I say national, I don't just mean government. I mean like all of us who are doing this need to aim for good AI governance is infrastructure with guardrails. It makes everything safer. And I think that's really important.
I agree with you. I think that because if we do overregulate, then we're not going to make the advances that we need.
That's right.
But like, if we underregulate, then people can get hurt and other things.
Right. Right.
Because I think there was there like a news article about somebody who was talking to their AI and something was suicidal. And I think they ended up taking their own life.
There's been quite a few of those stories over the past few years. And, you know, we talk about this a lot in mental health, which is that is dangerous. And at the same time, the reason people are going to mental health chatbots is because they can't get access. And so you also have to think about all the people that are committing suicide because they have no access to mental health care. And so I think for a lot of these things that are population level health, what we don't know is what's the denominator of people who are just not getting any care. And can the models we create adequately do two things? One is, sorry, I'm going to geek out for a second, but one is
I'm so intrigued.
Like, find things with high specificity, meaning if I tell you you have a disease, you have it. If I say there's a trend towards this, you show up at the doctor and they're like, oh yeah, good catch, right? You want that from your first models. That's going to build trust. That's not going to overburden the system, right? And then the second thing you want to do is you want to just understand like, oh, well, they missed some people. You use this and you missed. Well, I mean, we're missing people left and right in the United States for every disease. You are out there preaching to women to listen to their symptoms and to be willing to talk about below the belt. And the majority of us are still not willing to learn, not willing to understand until we meet you. And then we're like, oh, wait, this is a thing. Right. And so thank you, by the way, for what you do. But I think it's important to recognize that like this is an opportunity for us to use AI to find things, to help people. And we don't want to oversubscribe on like find everybody, because honestly, we don't have a system that could take the patients if you found everybody who might possibly someday have blank. So I like the idea of finding people like when I can do something about it.
Yeah.
Like that's a great place to start. And it's hard to say. Some people say, no, doctor, wouldn't you want to know about everything? And I say, no, I didn't do 23andMe. I don't want to know everything right now, because if you can't do something, I know myself, I'll have health-related anxiety about it till the cows come home, because I'm a type A doctor, right? So I think we have to think about those balances when we're thinking about using AI and the benefit. When we think about it that way, it's less scary, but also you feel like you have more power as a patient and as a doctor or nurse or clinician. You feel like you have more power because you're like, wait. Yeah, let's harness the technology for the things that we want. But right now, tech's being thrown at us and we're either just buying it the way it is because, wow, it's cool. Yeah. Or we're throwing out the window because we're like, I don't do tech. And like neither one of those is going to work.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Yeah. And I think like when we talk about the evolution of like say, treating women in the menopause space, right? We know that we cannot treat every woman in menopause in an office.
That's right.
Right. So all of these, you know,
new world, right? It's literally half the world, maybe more.
And so, you know, some people are like, oh, I don't like the fact that you use this telehealth platform. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, well, it gave her access to then come see me, but it was a start. It was a foot in the door. And I think most telehealth platforms will tell you they're not trying to replace the boots on the ground doctors and clinicians.
No. And in fact, a lot of people now are like, hey, someone gave me something that feels like an answer when I was super stressed out, especially now that we have wearables, we have numbers, we have data, we have ChatGPT. You have a symptom. What are you going to do? You call your doctor or you message them through the portal. And I mean, God bless the doctors that get back to you within a day, but they're just shy of being burned out. If your doctor is getting back to you that quickly, either they have a great system set up, make sure that's the case, or they're concierge, or they're just shy of like being burned out. And so I like the idea that sometimes there are ways to just get some answer, some help on your way to the system. Like we need a system before the system where, hey, I have some symptoms. I'm curious about this. I don't have a definitive diagnosis that needs blank, but like I might be on my way. I might have risk factors. I want to talk about it. And I think the people fulfilling that through whatever it might be, education, content, good social media, podcasts, telemedicine. I think humans are changing. I think we used to be like, oh, I want to see my doctor in person. Now people are like, you know what? I just want someone to give me an answer.
Yeah.
It's gotten so hard nowadays. And so I do think that the current is changing and the average consumer today is a patient is like, give me trusted information however you can get it to me.
Yeah. And speaking of the wearables, like I had a patient just yesterday inbox me because her pulse has been consistently high for like a month. And there were times where it went above 100 at night sitting, you know. And so it was like, she's like, I'm worried, you know, I'm at primary ovarian insufficiency kind of thing. And so, you know, I'm getting her to a cardiologist to do, you know, to get her scans and her Holter monitor or whatever so that she's having palpitations as well. But she wouldn't have really known it because it wasn't. Like I said, well, you know, when you were up at the higher levels, did you feel like your heart was pounding? Because like some people don't know what a real palpitation feels like, right?
Yeah.
So she's like, yeah, I guess maybe. But like it was triggered by the fact that she was like, why is my pulse so high? Even though I had no caffeine or I had no X, Y, or Z. Yeah. And so, you know, we'll see what comes out of it. But I think that, you know, it could just be a variable symptom, but we don't know because, you know.
And that's the thing. I think one of the conversations people are scared to have because they're not really sure how to have it is, what should I be measuring?
Yeah.
Measure 100 things a day. And when I say scared, I just don't mean patients don't know what they should be measuring. I think clinicians don't know what to tell people to measure sometimes. And so I spend a lot of time trying to educate people on like, here are the things you might want to measure. Here are the things you don't, right? In whom is an oxygen level actually relevant? It turns out a relatively small percent of the population, unless you're in the middle of COVID, different story, right? But like, so there are times also when measuring certain things are important compared to others. And so I really like giving people a better sense of like, here's what it means. Like, here are your numbers. And I think that responsibility lies with the tech companies. If the tech companies say you have 100 beats a minute, they should have something that says, hey, this is your range, or this is out of range, or here's some information about a heartbeat, or do you want to see a telemedicine specialist to talk over what these things could be? And maybe then they'll give you something to go to your doctor with. But I think we should ask tech companies to take that responsibility of not just giving data. Now they're doing a good job of giving insights, but then actually potentially giving care or the beginnings of an answer. And again, not over from doctors at all, but helping like bridge that gap from I have data, I have insights. Now I'm not sure what's going on. Give me some answers and help me figure out where to go. Right. And so I think, again, this goes back to that AI enabled or just like tech enabled clinician and patient who say, hey, tech company, don't just say it's a thing. Help me.
Yeah. I think that's where I see, like, I'm on a lot of Facebook groups of GYNs, and they get very frustrated because I'm not a traditional practice anymore, but when I was, you're seeing 30 patients a day, right?
Yeah,
and you get a patient and they're like, I'm so tired of getting this data from wearables. Like, you know, don't wear it if you don't want it. You know, so they get very frustrated and you can hear it. And I can see part of me used to be that way, right? Because I used to see mm-hmm. that they're, now I accept it because I have a practice of my own and I can do what I want to, you know, provide mm-hmm. the best care for the patient. But I know what that feeling was like where mm-hmm. a patient would come up to you with this data and you're like, okay. So, I mean, how would you speak to like the gynecologist who's like, why do they keep coming to me with all this data that I don't know what to do?
Yeah. So, you know what? I think two things need to happen. So one is we started this actually at the American College of Cardiology with the Apple Watch for the AFib reading because that was coming up all the time, right, in cardiologist offices. And so we heard that from our members. And we were, you know, you have 60,000 members, 3,000 hospitals, like yelling at you about that. And we were like, we will work. And Apple was great. They worked with us. And we created like a guide. Now the guide is like 40 pages long, right? But of like, what is the research behind it? Why should you trust it? And most importantly, I think the most valuable thing is the page that says like, what should you do and bring to your doctor, right? Like I think we need that for wearable companies should be creating that. Like, here's what you can go to your doctor with if this is happening, right? And I think that's really important to be able to help. And then I think it would really help if all the clinicians were also testing out wearables and understanding what they do. Because if we don't,
for that reason.
Yeah, like if you don't understand what they do, then how do you talk to your patients who have it? Now, part of that might just fall on the companies and say, yeah, like, why don't you educate the doctors more? Why don't you put some on their wrists and like have these conversations? Because there's a lot of good information. And the part I love is the predictive ability. A continuously modern day. So let's just, I mean, we'll go to kind of our subject matter together. If you think about menopause, perimenopause, affects the heart, affects the sleep, affects, you know, the mood, affects gynecologic issues.
I think Aura is doing a menopause mode now.
I think there is Aura, Whoop, I'm sure Fitbit, Garmin, maybe Apple down the road. But I think like all of them are thinking about this population. I was on a panel for menopause at Whoop just recently. We showed the movie, by the way. The menopause movie is so good. I think the important part is having a continuous measurement of what's going on in your life such that you know your own baseline, right? And then when you feel off and your numbers are off, what you want to feel is not scared that, oh my God, why is it 100, but I didn't notice. Instead, you want to say, hey, when I feel off, my numbers are in fact off, and I'm right. Whatever it is, whether it's exhaustion, whether it's disease coming, like something's going on. Now you have agency. Now you and your wearable are a partner together in your health saying, yeah, not only do I feel off, especially for women. Remember, so, you know, I think we talk about this all the time, but women tend to be kind of underdiagnosed, underappreciated, underscreened, especially in cardiovascular disease, right? They don't necessarily present with the same symptoms. They're not taken as seriously. A lot of people are turning away saying, you know, you have anxiety. They end up coming back in with a real cardiovascular event. And then they don't even get offered oftentimes the same numbers of procedures that men do. And so in a way, it all starts with agency way upstream, which is when I feel off and these numbers are off, that is legitimacy to me and empowers me to say, there is something, right? What comes next? What do I need to do to activate for myself? And so I think a lot of that patient agency comes really upstream before you even have a diagnosis of, I trust my body.
You know, I gave a talk just last week at the business school at Northwestern about the women's health and, you know, where the market is going. And my whole foundation of the market is that, or why the market, why sexual medicine is going to be a $1 billion market in 2030 and why menopause is a multi-billion dollar market is really because the central aspects of women's health has been an erosion of trust between the clinician and the patient, right? We do not trust when a woman tells us they're in pain. We do not believe her symptoms. And so the fact that we have to have you know, to me, I know what you're saying, and it just infuriates me too, to some degree, the fact that like we have to show you our wearable for you to believe that my pulse, you know what I'm saying? Like, and I know that when I probably don't practice that way, but I feel like, you know, we are built in a system of systemic sexism and racism that have existed before we have even entered into the scene, right? Yeah. But I just think if you look at why women's health is so booming as a market.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're exactly. So first of all, this is like, you know, it just gender disparity worldwide for a variety of reasons. Implicit bias that has existed for centuries and we are still fighting. So I think all of that
still
is...
Still fighting hysteria, the notion of hysteria.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's still called a hysterectomy. Nobody has changed that in the OBGYN world. Like, we called it a different word yet. I feel like somebody should. This is maybe my call to you and your call.
Yeah, exactly.
But like, well, we should call it something else.
We could change.
Yeah, that's right. But having said that, I think the other thing is, and just to be clear on, I don't want women to take their wearable and be like, trust me, to a doctor. What I want them is to trust themselves.
Right.
And walk in knowing and be like, I'm not leaving. Something is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I am certain something is off. I am telling you these symptoms. I need you to take me seriously. If you won't take me seriously, I will find another doctor to take me seriously. And I think that's what I really want. I want that empowered feeling of sometimes you're like, am I just tired? Am I sick? What is happening? And I think that's where that help comes in of like, yeah, I know my baseline. I feel off baseline and I see I'm off baseline. It is all tracking. And therefore, I will go be my own agent. And I think that's more it than like, hey, look, my wearable says this. I worry less about that. And I kind of, that's not necessarily what I'm looking for people to do. But I want them to be able to understand and know their own bodies. And sometimes you see those things and you're like, oh yeah, okay, like this tracks, this makes sense, something is going on. And sometimes it's not even an issue that needs a doctor.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's, you know, like every time I have that drink after 9 p.m., this is what happens, right? And, you know, I'm using that example from a friend, but, you know.
No, that's great. I think that's a great way to look at it. I think it does matter how we frame these things because, you know, it's all in, and that's why they say words matter. It's all how you would introduce something to someone to help them understand it. And I said, I think if we start framing it in that capacity, we'll use AI and these wearables as an adjunct to helping us understand ourselves and understand, you know, clinician can then understand.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the kind of the aspect of like how people see things and how we message, right? And so breast cancer does a great job of messaging, right? The kind of the pink ribbon and they do great message. It turns out that heart disease kills more women than all cancers combined, right? And so I have a little marketing chip on my shoulder. Like we have the Heart Association. We have Go Red for Women. I was just at a women in construction meeting. Okay, so these are women leading construction firms throughout the country. And I'm there on stage talking to them. And I ask how many of them have heard about or seen the red dress or Go Red for Women. And maybe a third of the room raised their hand. I said, how many have seen the pink ribbon for breast cancer? The whole room raised it. And I was like, this is, and so I think it's really, it is, but it's important because like, these are the things that need to be marketed and talked about. And so I think the other thing that I want from us is to recognize that our patients are consumers and that's okay. They are being flooded, especially nowadays, with information from every direction. Mm-hmm. And so the marketing budget, if you will, of the medical community to teach people about their health.
Yeah.
Is straight up marketing budget.
Yes.
Right? And we don't have that to teach. We consider education of patients to happen one-on-one with your clinician, which by the way, how stressed out are you when you're a patient in a room in a blue gown? Like, are you learning any? You're not hearing anything.
We're close when talking to them.
And so how do we find people in that receptive state where they're hearing about it? And I'm not saying they should hear about it through a company that's going to make money off of selling them a drug. Like we, the establishment of clinicians, should do health education as a massive marketing campaign. And I think we need to figure out how to put the dollars there. And I'm not sure who to talk to get that done, but it's one of the, like, after we figure out regulation, not deregulation, pro-regulation, but rather infrastructure, like my next goal in life is going to be, how do we actually have a massive marketing campaign about preventative health throughout our country?
Yeah, sure. I think that's the only reason why half of us are on social media, because we know there's all this other noise going on, right? That we have to like try to deflect.
And we want to spend our time not deflecting, but just teaching. And like, how do you get there? And how do you find a budget that big? Because if we really value people's health, then we need to educate them. Health literacy is everything.
Everything. Totally. I agree with you. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, like actual heart disease. I was talking about microvascular disease. I want to just talk to you because, well, it was interesting when I was at, when I was listening to the Menopause Society, I didn't get to attend the meeting this year, but there were a lot of great cardiologists there who spoke about a couple of things that I found that I love to talk to other cardiologists. Yes. One is the fact that you said that we have such terrible marketing that that most populations don't even believe or don't even realize that heart disease is still in that book.
Yeah.
The second was on the microvascular disease phenomenon, which I think we don't talk enough about or have known much about, or, you know, this was new to me as a gynecologist, but just understanding that, you know, that women will just talk to us about microvascular disease because I know it affects more women than not, and how can we go about getting those women diagnosed and treated?
Yeah. So we had a American College of Cardiology and Hello Heart Women's Health Summit just 2 weeks ago. And it was great. Jane Morgan, who's a clinician. So Jane was there. Mia Chorney, who does cardiology and menopause. Myself, Melissa Wood, who does Women's One. And so we were all talking about this. And I think there's a few things. So the first is what you're describing just for the audience is you have the big coronary arteries that kind of feed your heart that kind of we typically talk about plaque building up, giving you a heart attack. Note to self, women have those. Like we get plaque in those big arteries. And we get heart attacks that plaque develops at a young age. And it starts developing when you have hypertension that you're not controlling because you're not measuring your blood pressure. It is when you have cholesterol that is elevated relative to where you should be, but you're not necessarily checking it every year and keeping an eye. It's because you have things like lipoprotein little a, LPA, or ApoB, which are different types of cholesterol, not included in the regular lipid panel, but give you a significantly higher risk and sometimes a family risk of having blockages, right? And then you might be pre-diabetic and you don't know it. So all of those things at a younger age are what are taking years off our lives. Like we can take up to years off our life if by age 50 we have multiple of those factors. And most of us don't know we have those factors because we're not measuring it right. So let's just start there. On a positive note, you can add 8 years of life if you follow these things and keep them in check. Which is the best longevity drug we have out there is good cardiovascular health. No drug out there is going to give you, no peptide, no whatever, is going to give you 8 years of life. Right now. Only taking care of your heart risk factors. So that's first. Now, in addition to that, oftentimes in the smaller arteries, not only in the heart, but in the brain, in the kidneys, right, in other places, those small arteries can also get blockages. They can get spasms, right? They can get disease. And you may not see that as easily because we can't image them as easily. It requires a little bit. It requires thinking of it first and then looking for it, right? Or treating for it. So it's really important to recognize that even if people say, hey, I don't see the classic thing in you, your answer is, okay, look a little further and look woman specific, please.
Yeah.
And that's when we find that.
Hand is not classic for a woman.
Exactly. But I want to remind people that even though microvascular disease in women is so important, it's underdiagnosed, the majority of women have straight up disease that comes from being pre-diabetic, hypertensive, overweight, stressing too much, taking on everybody else's problem as your own, not getting in at least 7,000 steps a day. Like those things that you can actually work on, checking your blood pressure. Like if you're watching this podcast and you haven't checked your blood pressure in the past week, go check it, right? So those are the kind of things that we want to also focus on because I don't want people to walk away thinking it's the rare things that the women have. We actually have the common things. And we also have the microvascular disease, which is not rare by any means, but also exists.
And that's kind of like when you have the chest pain without...
Correct. You have chest pain, but your obvious big coronary arteries in the pictures don't come up as having plaque. And yet you have typical symptoms. And that's because it is a microvasculature. And so microvascular disease is what we call it, specific to women. And then the other thing I think to think about just while we're on the women topic is if you've had preeclampsia, if you had diabetes in pregnancy, if you had hypertension in pregnancy, if you delivered a child early, preterm labor, or if your child came out small, intrauterine growth retardation, those are risk factors for you developing heart disease. So add it onto the list, just like blood pressure or diabetes, like add that on, like woman-specific factor. Make sure your doctors know about it because, again, those things become additive over time.
When you talk about diagnosing for microvascular disease, I'm just asking because there's so many centers that don't do the diagnosis and treatment for it. And so I think you have to look for, but I think there is a website that you can find centers that do sort of microvascular disease assessments.
Absolutely. I would look for people who know about that. I think the important thing, and this goes for menopause too, I think it's important to recognize that if it's a relatively rare thing, we often have a tough time finding people who can take care of it. And then we feel frustrated. And I hate to say it, but like there are a lot of rare things. It often occurs with women or areas like menopause, they're not rare by any means, just not studied enough. Like, keep going till you find like a Dr. Samina Rahman. Like, don't stop till you find her, right? Just because somebody out there knows, and you just have to keep at it until you find them.
Tell me what's coming up in the market in terms of what you're excited about when it comes to like either wearables. Do you believe in these, the watches that check your blood pressure? Like, tell me what you think is going to be really exciting in the field, not only for women, but for like heart disease. And then, and we'll start with that.
Yeah. I'm really excited about the wearable market because so a few things. One is I've spent most of my life being inside kind of the big academic house. What I realize is we can't prescribe one-to-one to you to get you remote continuous monitoring to follow all of your diseases. Like, that takes a lot of time, effort, and we just don't have the numbers to do it. There are fewer of us than there are patients. And so I love the idea of patients actually being able to follow their own numbers. I do think we need education of clinicians and patients to make sure we're following the right things for each person. Okay, so that's that. But what's exciting? So I think things like, I'm obsessed with sleep right now. In fact, I'm at a new company today.
Yes.
And what I'm excited about with sleep is, what if there are ways for our wearables to start to help predict, hey, your sleep is changing at the same time that you're in perimenopause. When you started your estrogen patch, that sleep got better, right? Things that aren't particularly like healthcare, but that are actually making my health better. I don't call them wellness either, right? They're just my health.
Right.
And I think the monitoring off of these wearables, especially if you include some advanced diagnostics and other things that they're starting to offer, can really give me a better sense of how I'm doing, right? So am I pre-diabetic? Is this going to be a thing? How can I make my sleep better? Did the addition of that new drug make a difference? I think those kind of things and getting a sense of them is probably the next really exciting area where women are adopting AI far faster than men are.
Yep.
Like, at the current moment, since 2020, women adopt AI faster. So just think about what that means for our ability to measure ourselves and to take note of what's happening and advocate for ourselves. Like, we will catch up if we all keep doing this. And so that I'm really excited for that aspect of predictive modeling that is health, not wellness, not healthcare, that some of the really good wearables can kind of offer us. And, you know, I wear my wearable, and there are days where I don't check the app.
Yeah.
Maybe that's sacrilege to say, but there are times where I know I need a screen break from everything.
Yeah.
That might even include my wearable. But what I do is I don't take it off because I know it's learning me in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important to me long term, because what I now want to see is, if you start wearing something in your 30s and then you get to your 40s and you get to perimenopause, can I predict things earlier?
Yeah.
If things start to change, right? What about through pregnancy? So right. I'm excited about the real longitudinal use of some of these. And I think that's really promising.
Yeah, that is actually very exciting. Because again, we used to just broadly say perimenopause, your cycles will start being irregular. And now we know a lot more people start having the mental health challenges, having the sleep challenges, which nobody considered those in the past. But we saw it. You know, we saw women who were like, I can't fly anymore because I'm so anxious.
Yeah.
Like, I don't feel like myself. And that's what's being studied. And I think it would be exactly what we'd see with some of these wearables.
That's right.
What's happening with your pulse, what's happening with, you know, over time, longitudinally.
That's right. That's right.
Very so I do this thing, Vagilante hot take, which is like really your hot take. My husband jokes that like my listeners are Vagilante. So what's your Vagilante verdict? Like, what's your hot take for the listeners take home with them in terms of like one thing you want everyone to know, no matter who they are?
I want you to trust your voice. No one's ever going to know your body better than yourself. They just aren't. They can be a Harvard Yale educated doctor. Like, it doesn't matter. Nobody knows your body better than you. And if there was ever a time for women to stand in that truth, it is now. And if we don't, each individual woman stand in that truth, then I think a lot of the things that come down the road that feel like implicit bias, et cetera, like we could have probably curbed a lot of that by just standing in that truth. So you know your body, and you need to be vocal.
I think in social science, they call it testimonial injustice, where your story is not believed by the person that might have more sort of knowledge on the subject in general. So you should absolutely believe in yourself and advocate for yourself. That's the only way we can actually improve as a society. So I agree. That's great. I'm so excited listening to you, honestly, because the reason I started really reading more and studying more about AI is because of my own trepidations around it. But then I think I've said this before on this podcast, but it was telling to me that I took my son to his appointment a couple months ago, and he had the flu. And he's somebody that I used to like really have to talk to the doctor myself. You know, he was a teenager, you know, go and talk. So I went in with them and he basically verbalized, like spit out the whole thing on his own. And I didn't have to communicate with the doctor at all. And I thought, wow, that was so interesting. Like, you've become a great communicator. And he's like, yeah, I just talked to ChatGPT beforehand. And told him, that's what he told me my symptoms are valid. And so
I mean, I love that. That's such a great example, right? Of like being empowered by getting a little bit of knowledge. And what I love is, and people ask me this all the time, right? I tell doctors and patients this, use chat, be a patient advocate, be a partner in your health. But maybe also if you know you have a certain, you know, type of doctor, your doctor's not one that's doing that, give them a heads up. 2 weeks before, send a little message being like, hey, I looked a couple of things up on chat. I totally respect your opinions, but here's what I want to talk about. And then to the doctors and nurses, okay, like message back, or when you get there and you see that message that day, say, yeah, let's talk about that. But I also have two things we need to get done at your annual visit, right? And then, and look, now we have a partnership.
Absolutely. Yes. Oh, look, he knows you're almost done.
he was so quiet. We blame the teenage daughter who walked in with him while I'm on the podcast. Relaxing.
Just walking with him. Ami, thank you so much. This has been wonderful. You're such a wealth of knowledge. I hope to meet you in real life one day and work with you in the future in any capacity. I would love that. But for being in this episode, I'm Dr. Peter Mann, Gyno Girl. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me next.
Second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.